Hello and welcome to Martian Driving Podcast 145. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I'm doing very obscure old science fiction horror movies from the 50s and 60s. We're going to start with 1959 with a movie filmed in Japan with an English cast for the most part, and it is The Manster, starring Peter Danelli and Jane Hilton. Then we move on to 1966 for a movie starring Dana Andrews, The Frozen Dead, about frozen, thawed-out Nazis, which is always a good thing. So sit back and get the contact details out of the way, and we can start talking about two-headed monsters and frozen Nazis. Martian Driving Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema for as little as a dollar a week. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. Hey, how's everybody been? Yeah, the weather's warming up here. We've had a couple of winds. Everything's doing okay. We had a state election on Saturday, which was kind of interesting because we went out to get democracy sausage, which for those of you who don't know, when you go to vote in Australia, the school at which you vote runs a sausage sizzle. So they'll give you a sausage and a piece of bread. You can have some onions with it and some sauce with it. And it's a part of the democratic process for us to have a democracy sausage. So Sal and I did that. We voted. And in the state election, the Conservatives lost big time. They were already out of government and they died in the arse. There were some really cruel policies they were throwing together. And they didn't work well for them. They were kind of demonising African-Australian youths. They were using the death of a well-loved restaurateur. They politicised that because he was killed by a mentally ill guy who had links to Al-Qaeda. And so basically the good guys won for once. And that was kind of heartening. It was a kind of win that we as a culture needed. And we got it. And that was kind of cool. By the way, I am using the Richard rule here because good friend of the podcast, Richard H., has asked that we start talking about movies at a fixed point in the podcast each time. And I've decided that fixed point is at the 15-minute mark. So I'll start talking about the two movies at the 15-minute mark of the podcast so people can scrub ahead should they feel the need to do so. It's an ongoing rule for the podcast now to honour Richard, who's a great beer maker and a good friend, and he supports the podcast via Patreon. So I've got to throw him a bone. So thank you for that, Richard. Anyway, yeah, so we voted, the good guys won, and they won very quickly. It was kind of over, the county started, then about an hour and a half later, they called it. Now, the interesting thing for me was we were watching the ABC coverage, which is the national broadcaster were doing the coverage from the ABC studios in South Bank. 2 days before the election, I happened to be down there doing the radio gig, where Michaela and I talked about The Other Side of the Wind, which was a lot of fun. And I saw them setting up all this stuff, and I saw the cephalologist that they run with, the guy who does the number crunching for the election and the results, Anthony Green, and I wished him good luck for the gig on Saturday counting the election results, and he said thank you as he walked past. So that was kind of cool, and it made me feel more involved with the political process in a really odd kind of way. But so that happened. Really big stuff there. Let's see what else is happening around the place. Putting together a YouTube video about political films, kind of off the back of the election, because I did some filming on my Pixel 2 XL camera phone while we were at the voting booth. And I thought, well, I can roll that as B-roll in a YouTube video about political movies, and that's what I'm going to do. It's going to be a fairly big task because there's a lot of clips and I've got to be careful of copyright infringement and all of those kind of minefields you've got to walk across to get a YouTube video out. So I'm going to be doing that in the next couple of days. I'm also editing Sally's one for her YouTube channel where we went to an anime cafe for her birthday. there's one anime-based cafe in Melbourne. We went all the way across town to a place called Baldwin, where I used to live once upon a time in another lifetime with another partner, and I hate the place. It's kind of right-wing, conservative, dull-as-fuck kind of suburb on the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. But it does have something called the One Plus Piece Cafe, which is a One Piece-themed anime cafe. Now, if you don't know One Piece, ask somebody under 20, and they will tell you what One Piece is. It's an anime. They've had like 500 episodes. It's based in a pirate world, and it's crazy. The protagonist is a kind of ruffian called Monkey D. Luffy, who, by eating a special fruit, ends up being having the qualities of rubber, so you know, he bounces around, he's flexible and things like that, and he can't be beaten. And there are about 500 episodes of this Japanese anime. I've got the manga. I've got the first three or four bulk issues of the manga, so I'm kind of working my way through that. It's a bit of fun. It's got lots of crazy characters in it. It's totally over the top, as indeed a lot of successful anime are. And I'm going to enjoy doing that. And I've also got a whole bunch of One Piece anime to watch. So when I get around to it, I'm going to binge a few of those babies too, because you've got to keep your finger on the pulse. And if it's good enough for them to open a cafe for, then I probably should check it out in order to stay relevant. Now, the cafe's great. The burgers were really elaborate but nice. They had freak shakes, which are these enormous, elaborate milkshakes with all sorts of things. There were pretzels in them, Kit Kats, bits of cherry ripe, sour lolly straps, Pocky, everything was sticking out of them, and they were really tasty and fun. So we had burgers, we had the crazy desserts. I had an affogato, which was really, really good, and the prices were quite reasonable as well. They were really smart when they set up this cafe, because behind the cafe, in the street behind the cafe, is a school, and all the kids at the school are fucking nuts about One Piece. And so they raking a fortune. We went there at lunchtime with good friends of the podcast, Suan and Trev, and had a great time sitting down there and just eating this crazy food and looking all around us where there were like millions of figurines. There were life-size figures of some of the characters. There were posters on the walls. There were figures there. You could read the manga if you wanted to. They had them lying around as well. And the staff were really, really friendly. So really nice day for Sal's birthday. And we recorded that video, which I've got to edit this week. Now, I don't know how you guys feel about this kind of stuff when you're doing creative things, but over the last few weeks, I've been finding myself getting imposter syndrome, not only about doing the YouTube videos, because there are a lot of YouTube video creators out there who are much better at it than I am, but even the podcasts, I kind of have doubts of imposter syndrome about it. What gives me the right to talk about movies? What the fuck does my opinion matter? Those kind of doubts crept in. Now, there are a couple of reasons why. I want to be better at things than I am, but because I don't have any kind of formal structure in the way of going to work and things like that, I'm just letting the days pass. So what I've got to do is get myself into gear. I think once or twice a week, I've really got to sit down and away from everything else and do the creative stuff, because I think that's going to help me get there. Put on the headphones, because editing either podcasts, of course, or YouTube videos, you've got to have the audio there. You want to some extent, cut the video when you're doing the YouTube channel to the music, because I've got some music that I can use, which YouTube generously provide. And so what I want to do is cut the video to the pace of the music. And that's not an easy task at times, but you can do it. It's just one of those learning curve things. And I'm slowly, incrementally getting better at it. But of course, everybody wants to be good at things the first time they do them. It doesn't happen like that in the real world. But I'm going to noodle through there. So if you want to send encouragement to me, encourage the fuck out of me anytime you like, because I really kind of need it at times. Because like podcasting, YouTube videos are an act of faith. You throw them out onto a platform and hope that an audience finds you. And slowly I'm getting an audience for them, and that's good. But it's still early days yet. Kind of like the first few years I did the podcast. First couple of years I did the podcast, I was getting like 100 views a month. And no feedback at all. There's kind of nothing happening there. But slowly it gets better. As you get better and as you put out more episodes, people start listening to them. You start gaining an audience. You start finding your voice, which is something I've really got to work out with the YouTube. And from there, it kind of moves onwards. And it led to things like me doing the ABC radio gig and the Patreon page and all that kind of stuff. But there can be times when you have doubts about yourself. And it's okay that you do. It's what you do when you have the doubts. Now, I had a chat with Sal about this today because I really got to a bad place in my head. And we're kind of working through that. But, yeah, this kind of stuff is really an interesting thing to do. And it's fun to do. And it's a joy to do. And I love sharing movies that I find with you guys as an audience. But there are times when you can doubt yourself. And I've kind of been going through a little bit of a patch of that, but I'll get there. I mean, I've got good things coming up in 2019. We've got the Japan trip. There are a few other things. There are some personal issues with particularly my mother's health, which are not going particularly well. But we'll get through that, and we'll move on from that when the inevitable occurs. But, yeah, it's one of those things where I really want to get better at the creative things I do. And to do that, I've obviously got to put a bit more structure into the way I do them. Okay, so what have I been watching? A few things. I watched Skyscraper, the Dwayne Johnson movie, which was financed a lot with Chinese money and is set in Hong Kong. It's kind of like Die Hard with a one-legged giant Hawaiian wrestler in it. And it's, you know, no better than it needs to be. It's got a lot of good special effects work. It's got a slightly unusual setting, being set in Hong Kong rather than the usual generic American city. But it's just a blockbuster action thing that, you know, there's nothing here you haven't seen before. But it's kind of cool when you're watching it. But after that, it just kind of falls off your memory like shit off Teflon. No better than it needs to be. Did see some good stuff as well. I saw on Netflix the Coen Brothers' latest film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is a whole bunch of little Western vignettes, which are really good Coen Brothers things. There's the title one's a lot of fun. There are a couple of good ones towards the end. There really are a whole bunch of kind of Western stories that the Coens had written over the years and wanted to produce as a movie. And so they lace them all together. And it's a really interesting little piece. And the good thing is that because it's episodic, if you kind of get tired after watching one or two of the little vignettes, you can pause there and watch them later. It's a perfect movie structure, in a sense, for Netflix to have it running that way. So I'll recommend A Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Some really nice stuff. Couple of creepy ones at the end, and it goes from comedy to tragedy to surprise. There are some good action sequences, particularly in the titular episode, and some things in you've never seen before in a Western, so enjoy that when you watch it. Also saw a movie called Krakatit, which I think is Czech, and it's based on a story about Karol Čapek, the guy who invented the robot, in a sense, with his play R.U.R. back in the 1920s. It's about a scientist who invents an explosive that can be set off by radio signal. And he accidentally spills the beans on the formula for it to somebody while he's in a fever. And he's got to try to stop the world from getting this explosive, which can be set off with a radio signal with no other mechanism involved. So basically anybody can make an improvised explosive device anywhere fairly easily. And it's beautifully atmospheric. It's beautifully stylized. It's from 1948. And if you get a chance to, you might want to check out Krakatit, because it's done on a very low budget, but they do a good solid piece of science fiction storytelling within that budget, and it's really worth checking out. That's the lovely thing about being a film buff. There are always more films. Even if you go back rather than keeping up with contemporary stuff, there are going to be films in the past that really do surprise you, and you're surprised mostly that you haven't seen them before. And the two movies about which I'm about to speak are that The Manster from 1959, also known as The Split, and The Frozen Dead, starring Dana Andrews, about a whole bunch of frozen Nazi corpses. So we're getting right up on 15 minutes now, so I will play you the trailer for The Manster, 1959, directed by George P. Braxton and Kenneth G. Crane, and starring Peter Donnelly, Jane Hilton, and Tetsu Nakamura.
Larry!
From the exotic geisha houses of Tokyo to the back alleys of the Ginza Strip comes the terrifying news of a fiendish creature that threatens to destroy all who stand in his way. This is the frightening story of an American reporter in Tokyo who unwittingly became the victim of a shocking scientific experiment that turned him into a horrible mutant, half man, half monster, the Manster.
Got away.
I think I know where he's going, to Taurus. Follow me.
Right.
There's panic in the streets as the unheard-of terror of a half-man, half-monster runs wild through the city.
There he goes!
Don't miss The Manster, a genuine thriller in the most frightening sense of the word.
So that's a very bombastic trailer for The Manster, a movie about which I'd heard, but I hadn't actually seen it until very recently when I acquired a copy of it by means which may or may not be kosher. I probably wouldn't mind getting a legal copy of it, so I'm going to have to look into that. But at the moment, I'm saving money for Japan. I knew nothing about it, so I went in blank. I went in kind of cold. I didn't do any research before I watched the movie. I kind of let it be what it was. I knew there was a monster, two-headed monster in there. That's about it. So I went in there. First surprise, I didn't know it was filmed in Japan. And that's kind of cool. To talk about why it was filmed in Japan, you've got to talk about the guy who wrote and directed it, a fellow called George P. Braxton. Now, George Braxton was born in 1920 in Paris, but he started out as a child actor in the 30s and 40s in Hollywood. He was in a couple of Andy Hardy movies with Mickey Rooney. He was in Grapes of Wrath as an extra. He had a career of that sort. And then he went to World War II, because a lot of people did, and it was a very popular thing to do at the time. So he went to the war and ended up in Japan at the end of the war and stayed there for a few years. He stayed there for a number of years and he started making movies. He also made some in Africa as well. So he was one of those filmmakers who kind of jumped around wherever he could get an opportunity to make a film. In a country, he'd take it. Low-budget filmmaking, never the really great stuff, but he was one of those guys that just kept plugging at it. And his movies were never fantastically great. Nonetheless, they made enough money for him to continue doing so. He started out with a couple of films. In 1951, there was a movie, which I can't find a copy of, and that's kind of rare for me, is a movie called Oriental Evil from 1951, which is set in post-war Japan, tells the story of a woman looking for a missing brother. Her brother operates a small export business and has suddenly disappeared. Strangely, his business partner has also vanished. Doesn't have anybody in it apart from Martha Heyer, who was kind of a middle-range starlet at the time. And one of the things Braxton did, and this shows as well in The Manster, is he used non-professional European actors while he was filming in Japan because, you know, they spoke the language, basically, and looked right for the part. He then, in 52, made a movie called Geisha Girl, again with Martha Heyer and with Steve Forrest, an actor who, well, let's just say that he was a tiny bit wooden. 51, he also made another movie called Tokyo File 212 with Florence Marley is the star. Florence Marley, you'll remember, for a while later, was the Queen of Blood in that really bad Curtis Harrington movie with Dennis Hopper, where they stole all the bits from Russian science fiction movies and put it together. So she was that. Again, it's a kind of low-budget spy thriller set in Japan, of course. And Braxton made it for RKO, so it was the first Hollywood feature film shot entirely in Japan. Well, he didn't make it for RKO, but they distributed the film in the US. Haven't been able to find a copy of that one either, but I'm still looking. Braxton then went on to make some movies in Africa, various countries in Africa, and then made a TV series called Adventures of a Jungle Boy, which went 13 episodes in 1957. And then 58 and 59, he made a TV series called African Patrol, using a lot of kind of stock footage he'd shot in Africa. So Braxton then, of course, went on to make The Manster. He only did a couple of things after this, but The Manster is the one that I think is the most interesting from the sound of it and from the look of it as well. This time around, he didn't use American actors, he used English actors. There was Peter Donnelly, who was a Canadian-British actor, playing Larry Stamford, the person who unfortunately turns into the monster. Jane Hilton plays the character's wife, Linda Stamford. After they met in this film, Donnelly and Hilton married for the rest of his life. So they got on well during the making of this film. There's also an actress about which nobody can find out anything, but who's very, very striking in this. She's the femme fatale character in the movie, and her name is Tara, played by an actress called Terry Zimmern, who's quite good in this role, but never did anything else afterwards. Really attractive actress too, but just didn't do anything after this. Now, the interesting thing about Peter Donnelly is you've heard his voice a number of times. I'm going to play you a clip of Peter Donnelly's voice, and you'll know where it comes from.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Thunderbirds are go.
Yep, so Donnelly was not only the voice of that bit, but he played the character of Jeff. He did the voice of the character of Jeff Tracy in Thunderbirds. So there's your link to classic 1960s TV. Now back to The Manster. Donnelly plays an American foreign news correspondent called Larry Stamford, who's been working out of Japan, and it's kind of endangered his marriage because he's been away. He's kind of off around the place, and his wife is back in England. She comes and visits him during the course of the movie, played by Jane Hilton, of course. And while he's often climbing around a mountain to interview a scientist, he climbs up a mountain near Mount Fuji to interview a scientist called Dr. Robert Suzuki, played by Tetsu Nakamura, who lives on top of a volcanic mountain near Fuji for reasons nobody really knows. He's reclusive. And the set they use for the outside of the house and underground lab of the scientists is kind of cool because they've got a little volcano in the distance, which is a miniature kind of in like the other end of the set with smoke coming out of it. So it's kind of a cute, very low budget looking set to try to convey large distances in Japan. So he interviews Dr. Suzuki about his work about, which is to do with evolution by sporadic cosmic rays in the atmosphere. And the scientist tells him that he's found a way to do this by chemical means. So Suzuki, being the kind of person he is, drugs Larry and gets his assistant Tara, the Terry Zimmern character, that tells her that Larry's a perfect candidate for the evolutionary experiment. So he injects him with an unknown substance in his shoulder. Larry wakes up thinking he's just hungover because they've been on the piss together. And Dr. Suzuki, being the wonderful person that he is, decides to spend a week with Larry, kind of showing him the highlights of Japan. So they visit onsens, which are Japanese bathhouses. They hang out with geishas and do all the things that are cliched Japanese experiences of the time, which again you saw in movies like You Only Live Twice. They're the kind of entertainments that Japan had before they opened all the pachinko parlors and maid cafes in Akihabara. So Larry is there. He kind of falls in love with Tara and they start an affair. Meanwhile, his wife turns up and that causes more problems. But Larry is also becoming erratic. He's cranky. He's on the drinking a lot of alcohol a lot of the time. And he looks at his shoulder and sees that he's growing an eyeball out of his shoulder. Now, that's not your usual kind of thing. And Larry starts to manifest Jekyll and Hyde type symptoms. He murders a woman in the street in Tokyo off the Ginza. He kills a Buddhist monk and a psychiatrist. Meanwhile, he's slowly changing form and grows a second head. Larry goes to the volcano, to Dr. Suzuki's lab, sees all the problems that are going on there. At the start of the movie, we had another experiment of Dr. Suzuki's, who he eventually threw into a kind of lava pit that he has behind a heavy door in his lab. And we see a severely mutated woman chained up in a cage in the lab, who turns out to be Amiko, Dr. Suzuki's wife, because this guy is so far off the range that he experimented on his wife and things did not go well. So I know this stage of the movie is totally bugfuck crazy. It's low budget, around 72 minutes, so it's like minimum length for a feature film. But already we got some really weird shit going on here. You've got the lab, you've got Larry, you've got his friends and fellow journalists trying to do an intervention on him and get him to see the shrink who he kills. You have him attacking a whole onsen full of naked women, which we don't see naked, of course, because this is a 1959 movie. But right at the start of the film, they do a bit of foreshadowing, and we see a whole bunch of women in a bathhouse getting killed. And just when we think we know what's going on, Braxton takes it up a notch. We see Larry split into two people, one of which is Larry and the other one is a hairy monster. He splits right down the middle. They use a telephone pole to kind of hide that split as it's happening. But we're deep into the territory of body horror. We were already there. But suddenly, in a sense, Jekyll split and Hyde split apart in this movie. And Larry kind of wrestles the monster and eventually throws it into a lava pit, because there are a lot of lava pits going around. And we kind of have a happy ending where Larry's being taken away on a stretcher. His devoted wife, Linda, is with him. And the volcano has blown up enough so that Suzuki's lab is totally history. Oh yeah, and Larry by this stage has killed Dr. Suzuki, because why the fuck wouldn't you? The AI injected him with this shit, even though he did take him around for a good night, you know, good few nights out in Tokyo. It really wasn't worth it to suddenly be turned into a two-headed monster that splits apart. So this movie is crazy at a number of different levels. And it's escalated by the fact that it is filmed in Japan, so it's got that slight exoticness about it. If they had have just filmed it, say, in England, in Croydon or somewhere like that in England, it would have been a kind of prosaic little horror film. But having the Japanese location gives it a more exotic feel. Having the crazy sets they have there with lava pits behind heavy fortified doors and volcanoes in the distance, using a little bit of location shooting around Japan, which makes it kind of interesting. Women wearing Japanese dress being attacked by monsters. Women in onsens being attacked by monsters. Obligatory geisha scenes, all that kind of stuff, really does texture this movie in a nice way and makes it a little bit out of the ordinary. I kind of enjoyed watching it, even though I knew most of the beats, except for him splitting into the two monsters. And sorry, I should have said spoilers on that. Splitting in half, sorry, not into two monsters, but splitting in half. It's still worth watching. It's one of those kind of geekily watchable films. You get the popcorn out, you may have a beer or two, depending on whether you're so inclined, and just sit back and watch this film. It's 72 minutes. It's not going to take up all of your day. And it's fun. It's crazy fun. And the other thing that makes it kind of really interesting for me is that, in particular, Jane Hilton playing the wife, Linda, is fucking good. She actually acts at a higher level than this movie deserves. Her character is kind of worried. Yeah, she's in love with her husband. Her husband's drifting away from her for various reasons, part of which is to do with the fact he's an alcoholic journalist. part of which is to do with the fact he's turning into a monster. But she really does essay the character well, and even though it's not particularly well written, her acting gives us a highlight into the character. And the relation, because the relationship between the actors was real at the time, they were falling in love, there's a kind of intensity there that you wouldn't normally get in this kind of a film. And that, too, is one of the surprising things about this movie, is the fact that some of the acting is at a really high level, particularly Jane Hilton. And all credit to her for that, because, you know, you go to Japan, you make this cheap-ass monster movie, nobody's expecting you to bring your A-game to this. There are certain beats you've got to meet as an actor, and, you know, certain things you've got to kind of essay. But she really commits to it, and I really like that. I like the fact that somebody saw it as an acting job alone, you know, leaving the context out, leaving how silly the plot is and how silly the monster is and everything like that. Jane Hilton really does just, you know, inhabit the character. And that's weird and wonderful. And it gives us extra value to this film that it wouldn't have had otherwise. I really like that. It's one of those things that, even though the movie is ropey and silly and dumb in some places, little moments like that, and little moments like the split. The movie also had another name in other markets called The Split. But the split between the monsters works really well. There's a lot here. And even though a lot of the other kind of European actors, there's a guy called Norman Van Hawley playing a friend of Larry's. You also get a guy called Alan Tarleton playing the psychiatrist. Both of those are non-professionals. They're just European guys who were around and could kind of act. And they needed European people to inhabit those roles. And they're not very good. But Jane Hilton and Peter Dinelli really make it work. And Tetsu Nakamura playing Dr. Suzuki has a real weirdness about him that kind of makes the mad scientist character work. And then, of course, you've got Terry Zimmern playing Tara. Yeah, there's a few people in this that are really kind of doing some interesting stuff. And you don't go to these kind of movies expecting acting to be any good, and it is. You've got weird monsters, you've got an unusual setting for this kind of a film, and you've also got good and bad acting in the same scene. So that's a lovely thing about this film, and I really kind of have a growing fondness since I saw it of the film because of that. It really does do unexpected things, and that's a rarity in this kind of a film from this era. So not too much else to talk about The Manster. If you haven't seen it, definitely see it. Don't worry about the fact that I spoiled the ending of it, because a lot of the images we get for the film do that. But yeah, this one's really fucking wild, and you should check it out. I've already had a couple of people on social media tell me how much they liked the film, and that's great, but you really have to experience this one for yourself. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, we're going to be talking about a movie that's also bug-fuck crazy, and that is the 1966 horror film, English horror film, The Frozen Dead. Now, this is not to be mistaken for the TV series The Frozen Dead, which came out in, 2017. It's actually a French mystery thriller which came out called Glacé. But in Anglophone markets, it's called The Frozen Dead, probably to cash in on The Walking Dead in some way. This is not that film. So anyway, get back. I'll play you the trailer for The Frozen Dead, and we'll talk about why this one, too, is really unusual. And also, in common with The Manster, it has some interesting acting.
Haven't aged a day in 20 years.
But do you know that one has not survived? And seven are mental cases.
Top war criminals frozen alive at the height of their power, waiting for the moment when science will free them from their icy tombs to take vengeance against the world. And that moment is now.
Is there anything you require?
Yes. Impossible. A live brain.
Another victim sacrificed to feed the inhuman needs of the frozen dead. starring Dana Andrews as the scientist who tries in vain to wash the blood from his hand.
Mad. All of you.
A network of murderers dedicated to a monstrous project. Beware the icy stare of the frozen dead.
Okay, The Frozen Dead from 1966. It gets a 5.1 on IMDb, which is better than halfway, I suppose. It was directed by a guy called Herbert J. Letter, who made a bunch of really, really bad movies. The Frozen Dead, It, that one with Roddy McDowall, which stole some of its stuff from The Golem and stole the rest of it from Psycho. A movie called Doomsday Machine, which is really, really, really bad. It's in the public domain. He was one of the directors of that. It's got Bobby Van in it. You've got to see Doomsday Machine to believe it. It's incredibly shit. But Frozen Dead, a little bit less so. It's got a couple of things going for it. Let's see what the story is from IMDb. A crazed scientist keeps the heads of Nazi war criminals alive until he can find appropriate bodies on which to attach them so he can revive the Third Reich. That's not true. That's not what happens in the movie. Somebody is bullshitting there. Basically, for 20 years since the war, a Nazi scientist, Dr. Norberg, has been experimentally thawing frozen Nazi soldiers who have been kept in suspended animation in his English country estate since the end of World War II. Now, let's unpack that just for a little bit. Who's going to give a German scientist an English country estate in 1945? Nobody. How is he also going to transport the frozen bodies of German Nazi soldiers from Germany to England in 1945? You can't really do that without being noticed. So we'll put that aside after unpacking it. He's waiting for a visit from his superiors, General Lübeck, played by Karl Stepanek, and Captain Tirpitz, played by Basil Hendon, because Basil Hendon's a great name for a Nazi, who have been told by Norberg's assistant Karl, played by Alan Tilven, that Norberg's experiments have been a complete success. Unfortunately, they haven't. I'm reading this off Wikipedia, by the way. Norberg can thaw the body up, but not the brain successfully. All he can produce are zombie-like beings who can do no more than endlessly repeat the memory of just one action from their past. The worst of them is Prisoner 3, played by famous character actor Edward Fox, who is extremely violent. He's also Norberg's brother. You've got to believe Edward Fox did this for drinking money. He'd already been in some kind of minor roles in other things. He was in The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, This Sporting Life, he played a barman. The Mindbenders, a really good movie with Dirk Bogarde. He was a character in that. He was in Life at the Top, and he didn't get famous until later on doing things like The Go-Between, Battle of Britain he was in, A Bridge Too Far, The Duelists, Force 10 from Navarone, he was in that as well, Edward and Mrs. Simpson. So, you know, he had a reasonable career. Let me have a look here. He's also in Johnny English Strikes Again in 2018, a movie about which a lot of people have said bad things. So Edward Fox is about halfway down this chain gang of Nazi zombies who are wandering around the estate getting a bit of exercise at the start of the film. And you kind of look at it and go, do I know that guy? Yeah, that's Edward Fox. It's not James Fox. It's Edward Fox. And sure enough, it is. He doesn't get any speaking roles in this, but he does get to strangle people, so at least there was something there for him to do. Dana Andrews, of course, we know from any number of good films he did. He was in Laura, of course, playing the detective. He was also in Jacques Tourneur's Curse of the Demon, playing the protagonist in that as well. Good actor. He really did have chops as an actor. He did some great things on Playhouse 90. I believe he did Twilight Zone. Yeah, No Time Like the Past on Twilight Zone. He had a lot of problems with alcoholism during his life, and later on became an activist in alcohol treatment, alcoholics treatment, when he finally did get his shit together and kind of decided to help other people. He was also one of the returned soldiers in The Best Years of Our Lives in 1946, a movie I really should do for Paleo Cinema Podcast because it does have a lot to say about returned soldiers at a time when they weren't particularly being looked after. Not that they are in any culture that I know these days either. So Dana Andrews basically is cashing a check. He's keeping his hand into the business. He's essaying a slight German accent. And the lovely thing about this one is he really commits to the role. He's serious and kind of forthright. He gets all of the technical babble dialogue correct. And he's quite plausible as a totally fucking insane Nazi scientist. So Norberg brings in an American scientist, Ted Roberts, played by Philip Gilbert, to help him with his problem with frozen Nazis, because Gilbert's done some research, he's a scientist, and he's done had some success in thawing out animal brains. So they thought, we'll bring this guy in, we'll get him to assist us, and we'll figure out how to thaw out the Nazis' body and mind successfully. Now, one of the reasons I want to do this is because General Lubeck and Captain Tirpitz rock up and inform Nordberg that they've got 1,500 other frozen Nazis waiting in Germany for him to get his shit together and successfully thaw them out because, you know, it's going to be, again, you've got that logistical thing coming up. Where the fuck do you hide 1,500 frozen Nazis for 20 years? It's a real issue. It's not like you can stick them into the back of an abattoir. They need specialist care. And, it's a totally off-the-wall bugfuck craziness of these kind of movies when you start thinking through their premise. So Norberg has a niece who is the daughter of Edward Fox's character as things roll out, called Jean, played by Anna Polk, who arrives unexpectedly home from university in America and brings along her friend Elsa, played by Kathleen Breck. They decide they're going to stay there, but, you know, it's a little bit difficult because you got a couple of Nazi visitors happening there. You got a basement half full of frozen Nazis and seven different thawed-out ones who don't have all their marbles. You've experimented on your butler, Joseph, played by Oliver McGreevy, whose face you'll recognize from any number of things. Bald, bullet-headed actor, always played heavies. And so they've experimented on Joseph, and Joseph doesn't have half of his marbles there either. So suddenly Jean turns up, says hello to the butler, and the butler's kind of acting like Lurch on a bad day. Inevitably, of course, Dr. Ted Roberts, the American guy, inevitably meets Jean, and they kind of start up a relationship, as you do. Meanwhile, Norberg's decided that he needs a live brain to do experiments on. He needs a kind of unthought out brain, and the best thing he can do is chop off someone's head, keep the brain alive, put a clear plastic skull over the top of its head so that he can see how things work and do some experiments on it. And so what he decides to do is use Elsa, the friend of his niece, Jean, as the victim. So they kind of fake it up so it looks like Elsa's pissed off back to London, but she hasn't. She's been decapitated and her head's in a box, alive, and with some really bad green-blue makeup on it to make it look even fucking creepier. See, things just get weirder and fucking weirder as this movie goes on. It really does take it to the next level in the same way that the Manster did. They have a premise, they follow through the premise for a while, and then things take a turn for the what the fuck, and they move on from there. Norberg also has a sideline where he has dismembered arms on a wall, and he's running them electronically, so they're these human arms on a wall, which he's kind of doing galvanic experiments on. He's kept them alive by some means, and they're just kind of sitting up there on the wall. Of course, we know inevitably at some stage somebody's going to take control of them and strangle some people. That's basically why they're there. And we know also that there are some extras behind that wall, with their hands through a hole in the wall, painted up with kind of grey-blue makeup to make them look even creepier. So we know all that's happening. And so he's got a wall of arms. He's got 7 zombie Nazis running around, 8 if you count the butler. He's also got several more in a freezer, standing up in the freezer. And the good thing is that as they're doing the scene standing up in the freezer, the actors behind the glass who are all kind of covered in ice makeup can't really keep still very well. And so you see them wobbling a little bit, and one of them, his eyelids flicker. So there's some, they got a little bit of a problem. What they should have done was hired a bunch of mimes or something and got them to stay still. But they couldn't do that in this case. And so you've got slightly wobbly frozen Nazis behind a glass case in the back of the lab. Before I go further, I should point out one thing about the production of this movie. They didn't have a hell of a lot of money for it. Nazis are expensive. And so what happened was all of the prints of this movie that went to America were in black and white, but the prints that were shown in England were in colour. Vosmer would have done it the other way around and fucked the expenses because the American market's so much bigger than the English market, but they didn't do that. They went for the cheap option. So if you're seeing a colour print of this film, it's the English one. If you're seeing the black and white one, it's the American one. And maybe that's why the makeup was a little bit dodgy. Maybe the makeup shows up better in a black and white print than it does in a colour one. But anyway, that's just a side issue that I found out about, and it seemed a little bit weird to me. Of course, Ted the scientist finds out these things and actually helps the fucking Nazi with the experiments, which is totally fucked, if you ask me. One thing we know from 2018 teaches us is that you don't have any truck with Nazis. You punch them, but you do not help them resurrect other Nazis. It's just one of those things that's socially and morally unacceptable. Meanwhile, poor Elsa's got her head in a wooden case, and she's alive. And the really interesting thing here, and here's again the thing where someone's acting above what they need to for a particular role. Kathleen Breck is very good playing Elsa as a dismembered head. Now, you might remember Virginia Lee playing the same kind of character in The Brain That Wouldn't Die in 1962. Kathleen Breck is at a different level than Virginia Lee in that one. You can see her confused and determined. Facial expressions really convey the torment that this poor person is going through. She's painful to watch at times, not because the acting's bad, but because it is so good. And she's in there kind of, you know, confused and dazed, and then slowly she finds out that she does have some agency in this because she can telepathically control the arms on the wall, amongst other things, and she can kind of talk. Now, in the third act of this movie, she becomes a very, very important character to the piece. Again, this is it was a treat for me to see somebody acting so adeptly at a role for which there's hardly any training you can get. Acting schools don't really train you very well to be a head in a box. But Elsa in this one, played by Kathleen Brick, is really, really good. So she helps the good guys. Well, the good guy who's supposed to be Dr. Ted Roberts, even though he was cooperating with the Nazis, so fuck that guy. And Jean, she explains to them that prisoner number 3 is Jean's father, which is kind of not the kind of news you want to get, really, I suppose. But Elsa activates the arms and strangles some of the Nazis. Meanwhile, a couple of them get shot. Prisoner number 3 gets shot, and it all ends in sadness. Now, Jean, Ted, and the local copper are the survivors of the piece, along with Elsa. And we end the film on Elsa in her box, whimpering and saying, bury me, over and over again, which is a crazily creepy way to end a not particularly good horror movie on a note of real horror conveyed very well by the actor. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that she's, it's just a wonderful thing. Having people, I think that should be encouraged. What should happen is anybody who makes a low-budget horror movie ever should find one really fine actor who's willing to go the distance and chuck them into their low-budget horror film and give them something interesting to do. Because if you do that, it's going to lift the game so much higher for anybody with half a brain watching the movie. Of course, it's so much better if you can get everybody to do that and all of them to be adept actors. But in the low-budget film world then, as now, you're really not going to get that. So what you should do is just go, okay, we've got all these people who want to be in a movie. Some of them are not very good. We need to kind of spring the bucks for somebody who's decent, because I think that's the way to get long-term cult movie wonderfulness into your little piece of fluff. Also, the other thing you should do is have a plot twist three quarters of the way through the film that's not really predictable in any way. The head in the box is the one from The Frozen Dead. The monster splitting in two is the one in The Manster. You really need that third act, what the fuck moment, to make this really work. And both of these movies do it. They're not in any way good movies, or they're not going to be on anyone's top 10 list. But they've got those little kind of nuggets of goodness in them, which make them worthwhile and which make them watchable. And they're also rewatchable for that reason as well, just to kind of see how things go, you know, just to kind of follow the escalation to that pivot point, and to also enjoy the good acting that's in the film. Do me a favour and let me know if there's any other horror films that are kind of low budget and really fucked up that have a plot point where they pivot about three quarters of the way through the film, and B, somebody who is acting much more adeptly and with much more perception than they really need to for a particular role. The other person I'd say that does this, and it's from a Dana Andrews movie, is Niall McGuinness playing Carswell in Curse of the Demon / Night of the Demon. His acting in that is a joy to watch. It really is. He's one of the best evil characters in horror cinema for me. Anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there. It's time to knock, knock, knock that naughty clock that says it's time to go. And I'll be back next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast. I've got a couple of movies lined up which are big budget Hollywood movies from a certain era that I haven't covered yet in the podcast. And on next time for Martian, not sure what I'm going to do, but I'll find something after all. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you again to the Patreon supporters, who are unique and wonderful people, one and all. You too can become one of them by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donate a couple of bucks a month. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to do the credits, which honour the Patreon supporters for the podcast, and leave it there and let you get on with whatever the fuck you are doing. So thanks again. I'll be back soon. This one was fun, more than I expected it to be given the two films, but I really did enjoy finding the little nuggets of wonderfulness in both of these movies. So take care of yourselves. Watch some good movies. Watch some bad movies. Keep watching the skies. And I'll be back very soon. And here are the credits. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of movie credits to honour the people who support this podcast. Thank you to Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolour consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Jan, the dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, our set photographer, Mark D, our extra, and David L, our extra, Kerry H, who is the accountant, and our newest supporter, Gary J, who is a CGFX technician. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. I really appreciate you dipping into your purses and helping out with the podcast.